And it sounds like, and I believe you, that he is a awesome guy and that he's a safe guy. So number one, you have to go back home and you have to tell him everything that happened. And you have to explain the way that drinking triggers this survival mechanism in you. It actually terrifies you. Mm-hmm. And you might have to establish boundaries around it.
Okay.
And I think you guys can work this out together, but you got to be fucking honest with him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not like, yeah, it's okay, it's fine. Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, if you can drink on Saturdays and that's our deal. No, I think that there has to be something where he comes to you and says, hey, I think I'm going to have a drink. You cool with that? Mm-hmm. So that you have the option to say no. Not that you're going to.
Right.
But that you are given the feeling of control.
Okay.
Because what's scaring you is that when you heard that sound, mm-hmm. it was a signal that meant shit's about to go out of control.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know that even when he's opening like a Monster or a soda or like that same noise, it does it to me even though I know it's not.
That's why I know you have PTSD.
Hmm. Interesting.
It's just like a soldier coming back from being on a tour and a dump truck.
Yeah.
Sound makes you.
Yeah. Or a car backfiring or
uh-huh.
something like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's textbook.
Okay.
And so I think you also need to contact the VA or you need to go to your doc and you need to say, I need to go talk to somebody that can help me with PTSD because you need help unwinding these triggers. But the thing is that when you're afraid of something, we talk about the big stuff. I want you to shrink this down to that moment. And the moment I'm talking about is the moment when the wine comes out of the bag. Or the moment when you hear that can of beer crack open. And that moment is so wired into your body that it is profoundly triggering. Now, if I were the one who was deciding what to do for you moving forward, I would have a rule. I don't think you should be with anyone who drinks. And I don't think you should be drinking either.
Okay. You know, I've asked myself that question. If Lee didn't drink, it would be good for him and it would be good for me. That's an easy choice for me.
What do you choose?
I would choose him. Absolutely.
So there's two conversations you have to have with him.
Okay.
The first one is about the way in which drinking is triggering psychological trauma mm-hmm. and the visceral stored fear that comes up when you feel like things are about to get out of control. Mm-hmm. And then how you become Miss on top of it, on his ass, nitpicking, because you're managing your fear. That's one conversation. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is actually loving him enough. Mm-hmm. that you can have a conversation with him about your concern about how much he drinks for his sake.
Okay.
Do you see the difference between the two?
Mm-hmm.
You need to be responsible for what's happening in your body. Mm-hmm. He needs to be responsible for what's happening in his.
Yeah.
See, this is the thing about relationships, mm-hmm. is that relationships are not one way.
Mm-hmm.
They're a two-way conversation. And if you expect to grow old with this person, mm-hmm. you're going to have to learn how to grow up and have adult conversations. The issues that you have will kill your relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you both have issues.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, you may have just picked the perfect person to help you resolve yours. But how you approach it and whether or not you come from a place of love and trust and vulnerability, or whether you allow your fear to speak for you, that's going to determine everything.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually in control.
Yeah. Because now that I know that I have these issues, that I've allowed to control my behavior and my actions.
Not even allowed. Like, I want you to really get something. You're not responsible for this.
Okay.
You didn't do this to yourself. You are a victim of trauma. Your father did this to you. And I'm sure there were a load of circumstances that led him to be the screwed up, abusive asshole that he was.
Mm-hmm.
That explains it. It doesn't excuse it.
Got it.
But even though you weren't responsible for this,
mm-hmm.
right? You're not to blame. You do have a responsibility for healing yourself. And so when you understand that you're not choosing to nitpick, you are a robot that was programmed. You don't have control over this yet.
Mm-hmm.
I can expose the wiring, but you have to go to somebody that can help you in therapy deprogram this.
Okay.
And you have to go back into your relationship and into your household, and you have to remove the triggers that turn you into a robot.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be very interesting if the two of you were to spend 30 days without booze in the house.
Yeah.
And to just see what happens. So what are you going to do when you leave here?
I am going to call a therapist and make an appointment.
Great. That's awesome. And I have a second wish for you, and that is in your 40s, my wish is that you are present. I want you to go to therapy because I want you to get control of these triggers so that you don't have to live your life like a robot. And I'd like you to be really selfish and connected to what you need and to start making those requests. So I think you have an enormous opportunity in front of you. I really do. What do you want to say?
Do you think this will help me have a better relationship with my sister also?
Yeah. I think you're really pissed at her. There's a theme with her where maybe the two of you, and this is just a theory,
mm-hmm.
but maybe she was the one, maybe she was the rock. Maybe because you were going through so much of it together.
Yeah.
Maybe you needed her more than you realized.
Maybe.
And she left. And that was terrifying. And then she married a woman, and that was not what you expected. And for you, it felt like an abandonment. For her, it was her truth.
Mm-hmm.
And then she decided not to have kids. And that was another thing that felt like her getting further and further away.
Mm-hmm.
And so just like you're doing with Lee, it's triggering something that makes you pick. The fastest way to bring somebody back that you've driven away is to apologize and to tell them how much you miss them and love them. And then every time you're tempted to nitpick because you learned how to do that, draw them closer. And the way you draw them closer is with sugar and with honey and with kindness.
Catch more bees with honey.
Yep. You sure do. We all want the same thing. We just want somebody to pay attention. We want somebody to make us feel like we matter. We want somebody to notice. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you feel?
Good. Empowered.
You look empowered. You look present.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I love you.
I love you too.
So, how are you feeling?
I am feeling like I'm feeling empowered. I'm feeling great. I'm feeling like I have a place where I can start to and a specific goal to accomplish that's achievable, it's attainable.
Oh, I just got a little choked up there hearing the end of that. That was amazing. Cassandra took absolutely everything we discussed to heart, and she has made very deliberate changes. First, she has sought out professional help with the PTSD, and I cannot wait to tell you about the update. But before I do, I first want to go through her takeaways in detail because there are 7 of them, and they are packed with incredible information for you. The first takeaway. Drum roll, please. Big surprise. Come on, you've heard this 5 times. Can you say it with me? In order to get control of your life, you must first understand what you do when you feel afraid. You know this now. There is a pattern around fear, and you may not realize it. Every time you're afraid, you do the exact same thing, and it's become so automatic, just like you heard with Cassandra. It's now a habit. I want to underscore, though, that it is a different ballgame when you are dealing with patterns that have been learned because of trauma. And it's super important to have compassion for yourself and seek help and support in getting those patterns changed when they are patterns that have been encoded because of traumatic situations from your past. Now, once you see these patterns, you then have the power to change them. And if you change your response to fear, you will get control of your life. And that is totally true for people who suffer from PTSD as well. So first, ask yourself, what am I afraid of? For Cassandra, there are two things that she fears, one of which she knew and the other was hidden. The fear that she knew about was the fear of being abandoned, like the moment her mother and her sister would leave the house. The other fear for her, the one she didn't realize that she had, is the fear of getting into a situation where she was going to be physically abused. In her case, it all got triggered by simply hearing a bottle open. Now, once you know what you're afraid of, ask yourself, what do I do when I feel afraid? As for Cassandra, what does she do when she's afraid of being abandoned? Well, she's always afraid of it. So she's always mentally preparing for the people in her life to be gone, which means any relationship she's in never has a chance. And what does she do when she hears the beer can open and is afraid things are going to spiral out of control? Well, she starts picking on her fiancé and monitoring him, trying to control how much he drinks so it won't spin out of control and result in abuse. I want to play back a part of the coaching session for you, and I want you to listen to her describe how simply hearing the sound of a beer can opening triggers her automatic response.
I become this robot. I'll go in there and I'll have this like dialogue of questions like, so, rough day, what's going on? You know, and, just rough day at work or like whatever he has to say. It could be nothing. It could be 2 o'clock in the afternoon and he wants to watch a motorcycle race or whatever. Right. And he just wants to chill out. And I'll be like, you know, there's no reason to be day drinking at all, ever. Like, you should never be day drinking. Like, drinking is for when the kids are in bed and you're watching a movie and you're chilling out. And that's my definition, right? It could be different for him. But to me, in my opinion, if he has to day drink or if he wants to day drink, whatever the difference is, that's a problem. And so,
of course.
So I'm like, why are you drinking? What is the problem? You can't control yourself. And just like snowballs from there. Mm-hmm. And, eventually he will either excuse himself and go outside to avoid an argument or whatever. He'll go have a cigarette or go work on the motorcycles or whatever. But then I'll follow him and I'll be like, chasing him out the door. And I'll be like, then I'll find something else to be, and then you're walking away from me. What? You can't have a conversation. You can't like look me in the face. And he's like, I don't want to. He's like, look at you. Why would I want to talk to you right now?
When you listen to her describe that interaction, you can hear the pattern and you can hear how it just goes on autopilot. She called herself a robot, and that's exactly what it's like. The thing that's interesting, though, is until you understand why you have the pattern and how it's getting triggered, you will never have the ability to change your reaction to it. She knows that they need to talk. She knows that the nitpicking isn't working. But because she had never seen the pattern before and what was triggering it and the fear that it was connected to, she didn't have the power to change it. But now that she sees what she's doing and, most importantly, why? She has the power to do something about it. And what do you know? Well, if you change your response to fear, if you substitute a different pattern, you'll take control of your life. And most importantly, her relationship has a chance to change and become healthy and strong because she's changing how she responds to fear. That leads us into the second takeaway. And it's something I want to call out that I hear often from people who are in abusive relationships or who have experienced trauma as a child. And it relates to how survivors of abuse make excuses for their abuser's behavior. And in doing so, developed a very warped definition of what love is and what it isn't. Cassandra said something to me that really stood out during our coaching session, and I want to replay it for you and then talk to you about why it's important to understand what the definition of love truly is.
Looking back, it's like I mentioned how like my mom was like the nurturer and the oak tree and everything, and she was like unconditional love 100% of the time. And I know my dad loved us, but he just never showed it. He was just never sober enough to like say I love you, you know. But I find that as a child, I craved his love more and I craved his attention more because I felt like I had to be like, Dad, I'm right here. Look at me. Love me, you know, and I never got it. And I think that that just embedded and I carried it all the way through my adulthood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You carried that all the way through your adulthood. And did you catch what she said specifically? I know my dad loved us, but he just never showed it. He was just never sober enough to like say, I love you. Please, please stop justifying the behavior of people who abuse you. Stop calling it love. It is not love. I don't want you to feel like you're being made wrong. I am speaking with intensity because I want you to understand that abuse in any form is not love. They might have been doing the best that they could. I'm sure Cassandra's dad, if he had a drinking problem or if he was abused as a kid, he's got all kinds of issues and given his issues and his trauma, but that's not love. You don't hit people because you love them. You don't shame people because you love them. You don't hurt people because you love them. Her father did not love her. His actions said that he didn't because he couldn't. Some people are not capable of giving love or being in love. And part of the problem with escaping the cycle of abuse is that victims often continue to call abusive relationships an example of somebody who loved you but just couldn't show you. Somebody who loved you but was just too drunk to tell you. Stop doing that. The reason why you have to stop doing that is because love is the opposite of what your father did. Love is getting control of your drinking. Love is controlling your anger. Love is treating people with respect, with dignity, and with kindness. One of the reasons why it's so important to have a very direct conversation like this is Cassandra was really frustrated because she kept dating guys that were abusive, not her current fiance. But the reason why you keep dating the same kind of people is because you've convinced yourself that abuse is what love looks like. So you're attracted to it. It actually becomes your definition of love. And sure, your dad, he was doing the best he could given how damaged of a human being he was, and you can process it that way. He didn't know any better. Maybe he was abused as a kid, he's an alcoholic, he's got unresolved issues that he's now taking out on you now that he has a child, but that's not love. You can explain why somebody might abuse you, but please don't ever describe it as somebody who loves you. They just didn't show it. Bullshit. So if you're in a situation like this, I want you to stop saying, I know my mother loved me. I know my father who beat me loved me. I know my ex-husband who was an abusive alcoholic loved me. No, 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 no. This is what you need to say. My mother was so broken, she was incapable of loving me. My abusive alcoholic ex-husband was so broken, he was incapable of loving me. My father, who was physically abusive, was so broken, he is incapable of loving me. The reason why it's so important is because you are drawing a line in the sand, and on one side of it, you are shoving the abuser, and you are acknowledging that they are incapable of giving you love. And by doing so, you protect the definition of what love looks like, because it don't look like that abuser. Let me tell you something. And if you don't do this, if you equate love with somebody that treated you like shit or that abused you, you're going to find yourself constantly trying to put your entire soul into relationships with people who aren't capable of loving you. Because in your mind, you've got this idea that somehow a damaged person can love you. No, 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 no. Your new mantra, they were so broken, they were incapable of loving me. You need a new definition. Don't make the thing that you survived be the example of what love looks like. That's not what love looks like. And if you have that kind of warped definition, it's no wonder you have a fear of rejection, because it's starting off with an incorrect definition of what it looks like to be loved and to feel safe and to be respected and to belong equally in a relationship. And here's one more thing. Yes, I'm being intense about this because I want you to listen. But it's not your fault. It's not your fault. The abuse that happened to you, not your fault. The fact that you may have loved somebody who abused you, but they were incapable of showing you love, not your fault. But it's your responsibility to change your definition of love so that you can heal and you can take control of your life and you have a shot at getting into a healthy and successful relationship. Look, you have a huge heart. I get it. You just wanted to be loved. But the reason why you keep picking the wrong person is because you need to update your definition of what love looks like before you're going to find it. Now let's get into the third takeaway from this session, and that is this, that PTSD happens as a result of trauma. And, you know, most people think of PTSD and they think about military veterans. Even Cassandra, who's a vet, thought of that. She didn't realize that you can have PTSD as a result of childhood trauma, or as the result of a sexual assault, or as the result of being married to somebody that batters you. You can have PTSD because you're the child of an alcoholic. You can have PTSD because you were in an emotionally abusive relationship. PTSD can occur in anyone who has experienced or witnessed trauma, be it as a result of war, natural disaster, a serious accident, a terrorist incident, sudden death of a loved one, a violent personal assault such as rape, or any other kind of life-threatening event. And studies show that those who suffer sustained emotional and psychological abuse are also at serious risk for suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So if you have trauma in your past and you suspect that you may have PTSD, it is critical, if you even are concerned that it's a possibility, that you go get professional help. We talked about this in Rose's session, but let me repeat it. Your body and your brain and your nervous system remember trauma in a very different part of your brain. We talked about it with Rosa. And because of this, it's like a super memory. It makes the pattern much stronger to you, which means the trigger for it is very, very sensitive. I mean, think about the trigger in this case. It's just the sound of a beer can opening, and it rushes in all of that stored fear from all the trauma that Cassandra experienced. Now, I recommended that Cassandra go get EMDR therapy done, and I want to share with you something that she wrote to me about her experience in therapy, because she did leave our coaching session, and she went and did EMDR therapy. Here's what she said. She said, "Wow, that was exhausting. Today we just focused on one particular memory I have from my childhood when my dad was a particularly large asshole. I wasn't just recalling the memory. It was recalling the emotion I felt as a child, how that emotion has morphed now that I'm an adult. It was recalling the time of day, who I was with, my posture and location in the room. And I held that for 45 minutes. And when I had had enough, I felt like a nap and a cocktail, in that order. My therapist said it can be quite exhausting, as she's gone through it herself, but it can be life-changing when it's over. I'm so looking forward to experiencing this change. You know, it will be life-changing. I've seen the magic of EMDR in releasing trauma in people in my life and those I've worked with. And I encourage you, please take this seriously. Find a therapist who specializes in it if you suspect that you or somebody that you love is suffering from PTSD. Now, the fourth takeaway is that you're not a people pleaser if your safety depended on pleasing people. Cassandra said something to me that I want to play for you. She was talking about her ex, and she called herself a people pleaser. I want to replay this exchange for you because it's really important to distinguish the difference between being a chameleon, trying to fit in, versus being an abuse survivor and trying to survive.
Well, we share a daughter, you know, and he lives out of state now. And so the only time we talk, it's a quick like, hey, I'll meet you there at noon kind of thing. It's not like we don't have conversations. But yeah, we had to, you know, I was needing people to not, like, I'm a people pleaser. And so, like, I get really upset when people are not happy with me.
Well, of course, because you got the shit kicked out of you when they weren't.
So.
Do you realize this is a survival mechanism? You're not a people pleaser.
Mm-hmm.
Your life depended upon pleasing your father.
Yeah.
It's a safety issue. For some people, people pleasing is like something you develop kind of as a personality trait. Mm-hmm. For you, it's a survival mechanism. It is hardwired, and it had to be. Super important distinction. I definitely have the people pleasing, chameleon, lie to fit in thing going on. I've told you enough stories to make it true, right? That's very different than being abused as a child, having PTSD, and developing pleasing people as a mechanism to keep you safe. You have to identify which one you are. One is about being worried that you're about to get judged. The other one is about keeping things calm so you don't get the shit beaten out of you. You're trying to control your safety by acting a certain way. Because if you're not asserting the control, then someone will hurt you. You're not a people pleaser if you are a victim of abuse. You tried to make sure that you stayed safe by keeping the people around you calm and happy. Yes, it's a pattern, but it's one that is tied to being a survivor of abuse and PTSD, and it needs to be dealt with in therapy. It's not something you can just start thinking positive thoughts around and asserting your needs like a true people pleaser needs to do. If you have PTSD, you need to take this seriously and you need to get professional help. However, just to kind of round this out for those of you who don't have PTSD, but like Amy, you're a bit of a chameleon, and a people pleaser, and it's a pattern in your life, remember, it's just being triggered by fear, and all you have to do is catch it. Notice when you're about to go into the chameleon people-pleasing mode, take a deep breath, and do something different. Say what you really mean, assert yourself, or just start hanging out with people that actually bring out the best in you. Now let's move on to the fifth takeaway. It's about emotional landmines and the need to remove them. Emotional landmines are a field of things that are between you and the person you're in a relationship with that can explode. And wherever there are emotional landmines, you have got to be responsible and cognizant of the ones that you have put in between you and the person that you are with. In Cassandra's case, alcohol is a ticking time bomb of an emotional landmine, and she didn't even realize it was a problem. And the reason why she didn't realize it was a problem is because of the connection between her father opening a can of beer and the fear that she felt when she was little and what it triggered inside of her as a stored memory. And then the pattern that she developed as a coping mechanism to keep her safe, which was to hide, which was to be silent, which was to also be aware of, where's my dad? Where's my dad? What's going on? Is things escalating? So that she could protect herself and be ready. And it was a pattern that was invisible until it got pointed out. But once it was pointed out, it was so like, wow, how did I not see this? She was able to see that drinking was a huge emotional landmine for her. Just listen in to the moment she figured it out. Is it drink one? Is it drink two? Is it drink three? Is it when you hear the ice hit the cup? What is it that makes that tingling in the back of your head happen?
It's drink one. It's when he pulls the bottle of wine out of the bag and puts it on the counter. Like, I hear that noise from across the house. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, ugh, hair stand up, like the whole thing.
You know, when you hear her story, I bet there was a party that was like, how could she not see this? I mean, this is as plain as day, right? But the reason why she can't see it is the same reason why you can't see the patterns in your life. You only see the patterns when you want to. And you got to follow the fear and ask yourself that question, what am I afraid of? And what do I do when I'm afraid? So if you don't know what the landmines are in your life, I want you to identify the moments in your relationships that cause arguments, the moments where you feel uncomfortable or where there's constantly conflict. And I want you to ask yourself, when that conflict happens, when that argument starts, what are you afraid of in those moments? And what do you do when you start to feel afraid? If you go and take an inventory, you're going to come up with a list of things you need to talk to your partner about and to co-create new habits and patterns around together as a couple. And Cassandra, what did she do with this insight? Well, she got busy. She wrote to us about her conversation with her fiancé about drinking and how it's an emotional landmine for her. And I got to tell you, I'm about to read it to you, and I am insanely proud of her. This woman is doing the work, and she is taking control of her life, and she is seeing the results. Mel, I had a great talk with Leland. I told him about my father's drinking and subsequent violent behavior really did a number on me and that it's affecting my relationship across the board. He thanked me for telling him and said he needs to start being a better person for me and for us. I'm pleased to report, and I'm so freaking proud, that we have both been 100% sober for 9 days now. And I've realized now this goes way beyond just his decision to not drink. We've tried sobriety in the past, which mostly consisted of me telling him that he drinks too much and he needs to stop. So he would stop for 2 or 3 days, but then he would tell me that it was okay if I had a drink because I didn't have a problem with it. So my dumbass totally had a drink. I couldn't see it in the moment, what was super obvious, and that was that he wasn't giving me permission to drink. He was giving himself permission to drink. He was manipulating the hell out of the situation like I was the beneficiary. And from my perspective, I was all do as I say, not as I do. I was a total bullshitter. My coaching session has forced me to reevaluate my own relationship with alcohol and my role in Leland's sobriety. I realized that I needed to reflect what I wanted from him in my own actions. If I wanted him to be sober, I needed to be sober, period. If for no other reason than spousal support, but also, I get to lose all those booze pounds and I'm not spending nearly as much money. Having been sober for 9 days, I think back over the last 6 months of, quote, drinking responsibly, which consisted of drinking 2 or 3 glasses of wine every night, waking up in the morning feeling like shit, thinking to myself, I have to quit doing this. I don't eat a lot of food at night, so booze goes right to my head and my mornings are super foggy and the opposite of productive. Now we're supporting each other and we haven't had one argument. And I haven't been a bitchy man-hater or had any sort of anxiety. We've replaced our wine routine with a cup of chamomile tea, and I can actually get up and be a mom in the morning. Wow. That is absolutely amazing. It actually is kind of inspiring. You know, to basically say one change in your pattern makes that big of a difference in anxiety and how you're behaving and how productive you are. You know what else I loved is she actually admits, quote, I couldn't see in the moment what was super obvious. And that was that he wasn't giving me permission to drink. He was giving himself permission to drink. You know, what's interesting is she's validating something I keep telling you, which is when you're stuck in the patterns, you can't see them. But the second you follow the fear and you identify the trigger, and then you start to recognize, well, what do I do when I get afraid? Holy cow, I start nitpicking. It becomes super obvious. And the other thing that I want to point out is, you know how she said she used to have 2 or 3 glasses of wine? What is she drinking now? Chamomile tea. So she's using the science of habits to take one pattern, which is come home, have 2 or 3 glasses of wine, with a new pattern she's in control of. She's substituted wine and put in chamomile tea. She's still having a drink. It's just a different one, and a more powerful one that's allowing her to take control of her life. And that brings me to the sixth takeaway, which is fear of abandonment. With fear of abandonment, you want to control how hurt you will be. Fear of abandonment is all about losing control. And in her session, Cassandra kept talking about how she has this attitude that she can survive without him. And I want you to take a listen to how she thinks about a scenario where Leland might leave.
And so I catch myself just finding stuff to be angry at him for. And it bothers me because he's really great. And I know that, you know, if I keep it up, I'm going to push him away. If I keep it up, he's going to have enough and be like, I don't need, like, I love you, but I don't need this, you know. And then I'll be fine. Good riddance. You know, I didn't want you around anyway, or just some garbage. But, you know, that's what I've always done. And so, and I've always survived and I've always done well for myself. And so I don't know.
Did you catch the end? So she's terrified of driving him away. But then she sort of nonchalantly at the end goes, I've always survived and I've always done well for myself. This is classic fear of abandonment giving you a fake sense of control. By telling yourself, oh, I've survived, it's okay, you're preventing the pain of it actually happening by assuming it's going to happen. Remember Heather and the self-criticism piece that we talked about? Remember how she said, you have no idea how it's hard to be me. She was so hard on herself. Well, self-criticism is something that people do in a weird way to cope with environments where they're getting criticized. Like if you can criticize yourself enough, then it insulates you from how painful it'll be if other people do. You criticize yourself before other people can criticize you. And that way you get to control how hurt you can be. Fear of abandonment, super similar concept. If you've already played out the future in your mind as one without the person that you're with right now, you can't be hurt when they actually leave. When you see it coming, you start socializing yourself to the pain by accepting it now. You either then push away or you think about it all the time. And Cassandra's doing both. She's pushing him away constantly. And then she's thinking about how she's going to be okay if he leaves anyway. And what you're doing is you're basically bracing for impact so that when it inevitably happens, you've already worked through it in your head a million times. It's typically created because of a childhood loss or trauma. And it's really important to attack this because research shows that people with abandonment issues, they have lower self-confidence, they feel jealous more often, they have a hard time trusting people, and they have a hard time being alone if a relationship ends. So they tend to just grab onto the next one quickly, even if it's the wrong relationship. In order for you to move past a fear of abandonment, you must recognize that you are worthy of being loved. And it's critical that you do this. Because what happens for a child that develops a fear of abandonment, like Cassandra did, is as you're standing there watching your mother drive away, your child brain starts to think, well, if they love me, they wouldn't be leaving me. And you start to wonder, what is it about me that makes me unlovable? And you think that you caused that person to leave. So as an adult, it's really important that you rewrite the story and you realize that you didn't cause anybody to leave. You're worthy of love. Your mother wasn't thinking about you when she walked out the door. She did it because she was dealing with her own safety. Your sister was protecting herself. She wasn't leaving you. I mean, we make this all about us. And we never stop and think about why your mom or why your sister might have left. Had nothing to do with you. And in the workbook, we've got a bunch of exercises on how to recognize that you are worthy of love and to begin to shift the narrative that you have. If they loved me, they wouldn't have left. What is it about me that makes me unlovable? Let's get rid of that story and let's write a new one that's about self-love and self-compassion. The seventh and final takeaway from Cassandra's session has to do with how judgy Cassandra was about her sister. And you're going to learn that judgment and judgmental people, it comes as a result of wanting to control whether or not you get hurt. You see, judgmental people at their core are deeply wounded. I want to say that again, because if you have somebody in your life that is judgmental, and I'm thinking about somebody in mine right now, this flip in perspective, it's a game changer. Judgmental people, at their core, are deeply wounded. Judgment, it creates a wall between you and other people. That's why deeply wounded people build them, because they're wounded and they're trying to protect themselves. If you're a judgmental person, there's some unresolved hurt from your past that's continuing to get triggered in your day-to-day life. And so you get judgy because that button of feeling wounded and feeling hurt, it keeps getting pushed. And if you're judgy of people, then you don't have to take a look in the mirror because you're so busy criticizing everybody else. In Cassandra's case, she was crazy judgy of her sister. Now, after our session, what's super cool, and I'm going to give you a great update, she could see that the reason why she was judgy is because she was wounded. She felt abandoned by her sister, and that hurt her. Instead of saying that, she did what all super wounded people do. She started judging her sister because of that hurt instead of stopping, taking a deep breath, and working on why she was hurt. Where you cast judgments on other people, I want you to pay attention. Because often your judgments, they're created by your own perception, not the truth. And I want to share an incredible update from Cassandra about her relationship with her sister. The other thing I want to say is this. If you've got somebody that's super judgy in your life, instead of being triggered by them, try a little empathy. Stop and consider it's actually not about you at all. They don't know anything about what's going on in your life. They're so busy being hurt that all they're doing is judging everybody else so that they don't have to slow down and deal with themselves. So let me tell you about Cassandra's update with her sister. Here's what she wrote to me. Mel, I wanted to quickly update you on some enlightening new developments with my sister. I called her the same afternoon of our coaching session and left her a voice message. She called back and said that she actually had some things she wanted to talk to me about. She came over yesterday and told me that in July, she had flown to Texas to visit her father. She didn't have any good memories of him, didn't know him very well, and was really just wanting to meet him and get to know him. The entire visit consisted of him talking about himself. He made vulgar, racist, and sexist comments pretty regularly. He asked my sister two questions the whole time she was there. And those were, does your husband know you're here? And what does your husband do for a living? If you recall, my sister is married to a woman, but she didn't even feel safe telling him that. On the last day, she was getting ready to head back to the airport, and she told him that he is the antithesis of everything she believes in, that he's full of hatred and hostility, and that she's glad she got to meet him, because at least now she knows that she never wants to have anything to do with him again. And then she said she's married to a woman and deal with it. She concluded the trip a success. I told her how incredible it was that we were even discussing this, because it completely dovetails into our coaching session with my father being an abusive prick and driving a wedge between everyone. I told her that I was sorry for carrying all my garbage around for years. It was because I was jealous of her, that she is living her truth. And I'm here trying to sugarcoat everything and make sure everyone is happy all the time. She was like, fuck you, world. I'm going to go do what I want, and it's going to be my way. And I envied that kind of freedom. All my opinions of her, like she needs therapy because she's internalized this shit and never dealt with it, and that she married a woman because my dad made her hate men, they were all just that, my opinions. And I told her all of this. I'm the one who needs therapy. If she's happy, then no other variable in that equation matters. She, in turn, apologized to me for ever making me feel inferior or unimportant. We totally hugged it out like a Lifetime movie, and I felt like the last 25 years of distance vanished in a moment. You were right, Mel. Decades of distance can be erased with one phone call. And the fucked up thing is, I always knew that, but I was too stubborn to take any action on it. We even talked about taking a vacation, just the two of us, and getting to know one another again. I still have goosebumps about how this all aligned. We were reaching out to each other at the same time to get closure on the same issues. It's awesome. It is so awesome. And I'm so glad that she is confirming that you can erase decades of distance with one phone call. You just never know what's going on in someone's heart and mind until you have the courage to pick up the phone and have the conversation. And here's one thing that I know for sure. You're never going to have that conversation if you're so busy sitting around judging them. And now let me wrap up this coaching session by summarizing Cassandra's 7 takeaways for you. First, drum roll, please, because you've never heard this one before. Well, that's a joke. I hope that you never forget this. In order to get control of your life, you got to first understand what you do when you feel afraid or vulnerable. Cassandra fears being abandoned, so she pushes people away before they can leave. She also is terrified of being physically abused. And so the second that it gets triggered, like when she hears a beer can open or a bottle of wine coming out, her pattern is to nitpick and nitpick and try to control what's going on so that things don't spiral out of control. Now that she sees the patterns, she has the power to change them. Second, abuse, it is not love. Please stop justifying the behavior of your abuser and calling it love. They may have been doing the best that they could given their own issues and trauma, but it is not love. Your new mantra is, they were so broken, they were incapable of loving me. I do not want you to turn the abuse that you survived into an example of what love looks like. Please let this be a wake-up call and use it to empower you to come up with a new definition of love. Third, PTSD is not just for veterans. If you have survived childhood trauma, you may suffer from it as well. And if you suspect that you do, please go see a therapist and you might want to check out EMDR. Fourth, you're not a people pleaser if your safety depended on it. There's a major difference between being a people pleaser and a chameleon and trying to fit in and the things that you do in order to survive. If you're a survivor of abuse, stop calling your behavior people pleasing and see it for what it is, patterns that were triggered as the result of abuse. Fifth, please, please, please remove all emotional landmines in your relationship. For Cassandra, that meant alcohol. Alcohol was an emotional landmine, something that always triggers her. So she had a powerful and important conversation with her fiancé about it, and you heard straight from her, their entire relationship has transformed. Sixth, fear of abandonment. Fear of abandonment will trigger you to control how hurt you will be. And what you're doing is basically bracing for impact so that when it inevitably happens, you're already worked through it in your head a million times and you're not going to be as hurt. In order to move past fear of abandonment issues, you've got to do the work to recognize that you are worthy of love. Finally, number 7, judginess. Judgment comes as a result of hurt. That's it. If you're a judgy person, I guarantee you're deeply wounded. There's some unresolved hurt from your past that's continuing to get triggered, and so you spend all day long casting judgment so you never have to slow down long enough to deal with the hurt. And when you start to judge someone, please think of Cassandra's update from her sister. You just never know what someone else is feeling, thinking, or going through. What's the fastest way to find out? Pick up the phone and have the conversation and find the truth. And as Cassandra said, decades of distance can be erased with one phone call. So you might consider making it. All right, now I have a surprise. There's actually a 7th coaching session in this audiobook, and it's for you. Now I want to coach you. You've learned that in order to get control of your life, you got to first understand what you do when you feel afraid. Do you run? Do you silence yourself? What do? There is a pattern there. There's no denying it. And before you listen to this audiobook, you probably didn't even realize it. But every time you're afraid, you react in the same way. And it's become so automatic that it is now a habit. And that habit, it is keeping you stuck. But as your coach, I am telling you, once you see this pattern, you got the power to change it. And if you change your response to situations that make you feel nervous or afraid, you're going to take control of your life. That's how you do it. Now, for each of the six people that you heard me coach, you learned what they were afraid of, and then you learned the pattern of behavior that they were stuck in, and you learned that by identifying the pattern, that they were able to move forward with a different response to things that make them nervous or afraid. But in order to do that, you have to first become aware of how fear and nerves are felt in your body. You see, you have body wisdom. I have it, you have it, we all have it, but you might not be paying attention to it. Well, that's got to change. So I want to ask you a question as your coach. And it's the same question that I asked you at the very beginning of this book. What makes you feel afraid or nervous? What are you afraid of? And to help you answer this, I'm going to remind you of what you learned about the six men and women that you just listened to. Dan is afraid that he's not going to figure out what he should do with his life. Heather is terrified of failing. Rosa is afraid of facing the mess that her life has become. Casey, he's afraid of being put on the spot or called out. Amy, she's afraid of conflict and of being yelled at. And Cassandra, she's afraid of being abandoned. And as a domestic violence survivor, she's terrified of being beat up again. Now, me, I'm afraid of disappointing people. Maybe you're afraid of one of the things that I just said, or maybe it's something else. Maybe you're afraid of not living up to your potential or screwing up your kids, or maybe you're afraid that you're really not that great under the surface, or you're afraid that people are judging you, or you're afraid of being criticized, or you're afraid of being alone, or you're afraid of disappointing people, or maybe you're afraid you're not enough. Whatever it is that you're afraid of, it's personal to you. Being afraid, being nervous, totally normal. But you can control what you do in response to it. And remember, there is an amazingly tight connection between fear and control. Then what I want you to do is I want you to start paying attention to when those nerves or that feeling of fear is present in your body. Tune into it. What does it feel like for you? What does your body do? Because becoming aware of the way your body physically manifests your nerves and fears, it's going to help you recognize when you're getting triggered before that fear rises up and turns into thoughts that start to spiral and make you run or be silent. Because once you know what you're afraid of, and once you've identified and have the awareness about the way your body feels and expresses fear and nerves, now I want you to think about this. What do you do when you feel nervous or afraid? What do you do when you feel nervous or afraid? For Dan, he's afraid he's not going to figure out what to do with his life, so that triggers him to try to figure it out by thinking and thinking and thinking, and all this thinking, it keeps him stuck spinning ideas. For Heather, because she's afraid of failing, she doesn't even try. So fear triggers her to not do anything. For Rosa, because she's afraid of facing the mess that she believes her life has become, she clings to her stuff because it gives her a sense of momentary control, because it's at least something that she can hold on to. The other stuff feels too big, so fear triggers her to focus and obsess about her things. For Casey, because he's afraid of being judged and called out, he tries to manage what people think about him, and he avoids situations in which he feels put on the spot, so he avoids the office like the plague, and he's questioning what his family does. So fear is triggering him to isolate himself. For Amy, because she's afraid of conflict and being yelled at, she stays silent and keeps her mouth closed, particularly at work. So fear triggers her to be quiet. For Cassandra, because she's afraid of being abandoned, she's always preparing for the people in her life to be gone. So fear is triggering her to push people away to prepare. And she's also afraid of getting into a situation as a domestic violence survivor where she's being physically abused. And so she monitors and she nitpicks the people in her life in order to try to control their behavior, particularly drinking. And she does it so things don't spin out of control. So fear is triggering her to micromanage and to nitpick. For me, well, sometimes I run in panic, and whenever I'm afraid of disappointing people, I lie and I act like a chameleon in order to fit in. At least I used to. You see, I discovered the pattern, and I changed it, and so can you. And now it's your turn to answer the question, because you have a pattern. Whenever you feel nervous or afraid, there is a pattern there. What do you do? You got to see the pattern, because then you have the power to change it. And that's how you take control of your life. That's how I stopped panicking. That's how I stopped being concerned about what other people think. That's how I stopped being insecure. I discovered the pattern that nerves and that fear was triggering. Now, you've heard me say this over and over again, and that's because I want you to figure out this pattern. After identifying the pattern for yourself, you now need to create a new response to fear. That's exactly what you heard all six people do. For Dan, he is triggered to think and think and think when he feels nervous and afraid. So he's going to replace thinking with moving brick by brick, one action at a time. For Heather, fear triggered her to be so hard on herself, and that was paralyzing. So she's going to replace putting herself down and not trying with a growth mindset and focusing on her effort. For Rosa, her fears triggered her to start hoarding things. And so she's replacing hoarding with getting rid of things so she can make room for more empowered change. For Casey, his fears triggered him to hide. So he's going to replace avoiding situations in which he feels put on the spot by showing up at his office and owning his story with his family and friends. For Amy, well, she's already replacing shutting up with speaking up. And for Cassandra, she's stopped nitpicking and has started sharing how she really feels, and that's given her immediate control. And she's also swapped out her habit of grabbing alcohol and swapped in a cup of chamomile tea. So what pattern are you going to change? I want you to decide on a new empowering pattern, and I want you to start using that in place of the thing that you do when you normally feel nervous or afraid. If you're silent, speak up. If you overthink, take action. If you run, stand your ground. You heard how Cassandra's life is being transformed, and I promise you, when you start to attack these patterns, you will take control and your life will be transformed too. But there's one more important thing that I need to say to you. You can identify your fear. You can figure out the pattern that you turn to. And you can pick out a new empowering pattern. You can stop running from the things that scare you. You can stop being silent when you feel nervous. You have the self-awareness to do all of this. But to actually pivot and break the pattern that's not serving you and to act in a new way that gives you control, a way that's truly aligned with the things that you want versus letting fear win and being triggered all the time. You got to take action. I'm sorry. There is no way around this. Just think about Amy. She walked right into her boss's office, despite the fact that her neck was on fire and her stomach was flipping out. She took control. It's so easy to go on autopilot and default to all those patterns of being silent and running away because you have used them over and over and over again. But now you have the tools to interrupt this pattern, but it's going to be a choice. You have to use them. You have to use them every single day, because I think one of the other things that you learned by being with me and listening to this is it's all taking place in the little moments. It's the stuff that's happening every day, the small ways that you silence yourself, the small ways that you think instead of take action, the small ways that you run away from the things that scare you. I don't want you to finish this book and think, that was great. All right, what am I going to listen to next? I want you to prove it. Prove to yourself that you can change, because I know you can. Brick by brick, one small action at a time. The patterns from your past do not define you unless you let them. Every day, every moment, you have a chance to silence fear. Because every single day, there are going to be moments and there are going to be people that make you feel nervous. There are going to be situations that make you feel a little afraid. There are going to be things that make you start to feel like things are about to go out of control. Do not run. Do not hide. Do not be silent. Yes, you may get triggered. Yes, you may feel yourself reach for the pattern, but now you get to decide what's true for you. Who are you now? A lot of this stuff happened in the past. A lot of these patterns you created in order to deal with other people in your life. A lot of the things that you do when you run and you silence yourself, you did it to survive when you were little. But when you let fear control your life now, you're giving permission to those people from your past to decide what's true for you now. Stop it. You decide what's true. And you do it by